Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Are we flesh and bone? Are we just a dream? Are we lost or found or somewhere in between? Do we ever get where we wanna be? Did we invent heaven to keep us in line? Like the sun and the moon are the ones telling time. Nothing could stop me from wandering. Does the sky get tired of holding our prayers? Do they even make it up there? Even if I could see behind the curtain, maybe the knowledge would just...
You know, one of the happy parts of my day really is just sitting around in my office deciding what kind of music we're going to use. Not just what kind of music, but which songs we're going to use in and out of segments on a show. It's just sort of a happy time for me. You know, it's not that the rest of my life is an unending veil of misery either, but still, the music is a little bright spot. And then I always wind up learning more and more about the music, too, which is fun. First of all, my name is Colin McEnroe. Welcome. We are going to do a show today in a format we refer to as Ask or Tell Me Anything. The way that this format functions is you call the following number, 888-720-9677, to talk about anything that's on your mind. It could be something that's bothering you. It could be something that's amusing you. It could be an irresolvable question. It could be a personal problem you're having that you'd like some help with. Although, why in the world you would go to someone like me with that? Well, anyway, that's your own business. But anyway, the number is 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WNPR. There are really no other particular boundaries other than common sense and common decency that we... And actually, common sense is not... We're not really interested in common sense. It's just other than common decency, there are no real limitations on what you can call about. So yeah, 888-720-WNPR, if you're into the alphanumeric thing. What else do I need to say? What I'll talk about till somebody calls up is... a kind of crossroads, I think, that we feel we're at with our show. We come to crossroads all the time. It's not as though this is a particularly dire crossroads. But if you listen to our show a lot, you know that one of the things we like to do is to explore rather esoteric concepts, things that we found out about that we think we could maybe make intelligible to you in a very interesting way. We continue to do that. And another thing we like to do is take something rather ordinary and kind of, I don't know, tear it apart, tear into it, rip it apart, find out its DNA structure, explain it to you in a way that's new, something that you've, you know, had in your life, taken for granted. We like little sort of physical objects. You know, what do they really mean? And we do other things as well, but those are two major ones for us. What we've done off and on over the course of our history as a radio show is also tackle topics in the news. One reason that I like to do this particular format, Ask or Tell Me Anything, where you call 888-720-9677. If I say the number a lot, it usually means that nobody's called up yet. Okay, somebody's calling up. 888-720-WNPR. One of the things that, one of the reasons I like to do this is because, you know, people will, although they don't necessarily have to, and they don't necessarily actually do this, but they can bring up things in the news. And I feel like 2024, you know, I've lived a long life at this point, And I've lived through some pretty freaking weird years. But I think 2024 may stand out, you know, even in the very convulsive company of the last 69 years of American history. And I've said to my producers a few times, we really, you know, we can't turn away from what's happening, maybe as much as we sometimes like to do. We sometimes like to give people a break. You know, it's kind of like, okay, so you don't have to worry about this particular thing. You don't have to worry about Gaza for an hour because we're going to talk to you about chairs. Or Occam's razor or something, or Yacht Rock. We'll take your mind off some of the problems of the world. And people like that. We call it free parking. People like the free parking. They feel like their lives and brains are just crammed with all kinds of things. And they like a nice little break now and then. But it feels irresponsible not to be considering what's going on in the world these days. So we're doing that too. We're doing probably more of it. I mean, we did a whole show on the Supreme Court last week. We're doing another show on the Supreme Court this week. And then probably we'll back off. All right. I think it's time to get going with Ask or Tell Me Anything. We're going to start with, we're not going to start with that because it didn't work. But the whole thing has crashed. all right. Don from Wallingford. Hey, Don, you there?
Hi, Colin. Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for everything you do, and thanks for letting me be the first call. Yeah, I have just a couple of language points that I wanted to get your reaction to. Most people say long lived.
Mm-hmm.
I say long lived because it means having a long life. As in broad leaved means having broad leaves. Where do you come out on the long lived, long lived?
First of all, I feel the bleeding edge of it is not long lived and long lived. I don't know why I'm about to say this, but it's short lived and short lived. First of all, I think people use that particular construction more. My short lived period as you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Okay.
And I'm also, one of the changes I've made in my life, Don, is I've gone from being a prescriptive person about language to a descriptive person about language.
Really?
Yeah, I know. But here's the problem. Let me just explain this for the listeners. This is something lexicographers talk about, that you can either be prescriptive. So if you're prescriptive, then the phrase beg the question has a very specific meaning. It has a meaning that has its roots in philosophy. It means to sort of, to fail to come up with a true answer to a question, but simply to restate it instead. So that's what beg the question means, except that that's not what beg the question means anymore because people just use it as a substitute for raise the question. And so a descriptive person says, okay, so that's what it means now. And I was prescriptive for a long time, but I feel like if you're not descriptive, you're just going to sound like an old man yelling at clouds. You know, it's just like, that's not what it means. I know what it means.
Yeah,
you don't want to be that. At least I don't want to be that person anymore. So I would say, I think your rationale is at least partially possible. On the other hand, I think most
people don't know whether.
Go ahead.
One is whether there is such a thing as objective correctness and incorrectness. There's, if anything, a very fuzzy line between the correct and incorrect of short-lived, short-lived.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm sure a dictionary would tell us something, but here's what I think. I think most people say short-lived, not short-lived. I also think that they might have a point, and here's the point that they might have, that there isn't really a verb, there isn't really a verb form that is pronounced live. You know, like, I don't live a long life, I live a long life. So,
but it's not a verb form, it's a noun form, lived, meaning having a life that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying, but on the other hand, if to have a D after it, if you're gonna add a D to something, you're saying it's a verb form. You know that you're saying you're making it into a. If you want to be technical about it, you're making it into a past participle at that point. So I mean, it's sort of a weird little flaky, funky
I know.
Concoction, I mean, anyway.
There's an expression we use in a certain 12-step fellowship that I'm a member of. Would you rather be right or happy? So, you know.
Is there a correct answer to that?
Well, it's whatever you say is your correct answer, you know.
Yeah.
And I seem to be kind of leaning towards being right and being not miserable, but, you know, being frustrated and calling radio calling shows and whatever. So,
well, I think that's a very healthy response, but
you remind me of the baseball announcers who are all saying he flew out to center field.
Yeah.
No, he flied out. He hit a fly ball. He flied out. I think is the only way to go.
That's a really interesting one too. I can see that that's an interesting one too, because although fly really is a verb, flied doesn't really exist anywhere.
Guy didn't fly.
but if flied doesn't exist anywhere, then lived doesn't exist anywhere either.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with short lived. That's my final rule.
One more. Everybody I hear, most people I hear in professional speaking positions on TV and media say Smith versus Jones.
Yeah.
As opposed to Smith versus Jones.
Yes. All right, well, then this time, I think we are in total agreement. It is versus.
I mean, how did this happen, and how do we stop it? It's so ugly.
Those are two very different questions. What happened is people just get lazy and they don't know any better. How do we stop it? I don't know. You know, I mean,
I'll call you when I get the answer.
I'm all for the restoration of the English language. Okay. Well, listen. Thanks for your call. Thanks for calling in. And we have other callers here. And the problem is that the piece of software that we use is just kind of gone. So, I can't even see them, the cat. So just tell me the name of whom you're about to punch in. And maybe during the first break we can try to. All right. Very excited to talk to Mary Beth from West Hartford. Hi, Mary Beth. You are on the air. Hi.
Hi. I liked what you said about choosing the songs, but you didn't tell us what the song was. So I'd love it if you could announce what the song and the artist is when you play those little snippets.
That's a really good point. And, you know, we do it. It's called bumper music. And as sort of in the terms of art or even just the thinking of public radio and radio in general, these are kind of, you know, they just exist to create space in between segments of the show. But I totally agree. That particular song is called One Less Question. It was by Madi, M-A-D-I, Florence, and Lennon Stella. A fun fact for anybody who watched the TV series Nashville, there were these two incredibly enchanting young sisters who were on the show. And they played sisters on the show, and they're real-life sisters. Lennon Stella is one of them. Although she and her sister were a duo for a while. And I was trying to research this a little bit. It looks like they kind of broke off, and then Lennon Stella went off on her own, which I'm sure it was an amicable thing. It just kind of, I'm not going to sing with my sister anymore. I mean, what if other sisters did that? Anyway, that's the answer to your question.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that I can help you with, or was that it?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for calling. I will tell you, anybody who wants to know this, we're going to go out of this segment. We're not doing that right this second because I want to stay here and try to talk to people with the technology. It's not working. When we go out of the segment, you may think you almost sort of recognize the song that you hear. And I'm going to tell you that on Saturday night, my son and I, we're often, I visit him late at night because that's when he likes to be visited. And we started watching, not for the first, second, third, or fourth time, the movie Fifth Element. And there's a scene early on where Bruce Willis, who drives a flying taxi cab, has to evade the police. And this really sort of chaotic, exciting, wonderful music kicks up. And I've always wondered what it was. And I found out what it was. And we're going to play that when we go out of this segment. All right. So let's talk. I'm very excited to talk to Chris and Avon. So let's get to that right now. Chris and Avon, as soon as you are ready, you may speak.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm airing a grievance.
Okay.
And the grievance is people backing up into parking spaces.
All right. So I should say, let's set the scene here. Obviously, there are two kinds of people, and there really are. Out in the newsroom right now, not too far from where I'm sitting, Kyone Wolf is standing at her workstation. Kyone Wolf is a backer into stations. And these days, she has this just If I may say this on NPR, she has a big-ass yellow pickup truck, and she backs it into spaces. And I'm very impressed by that because it's got quite a width to it. But she's a backer-inner. I have some problems with backer-inners, and I am not a backer-inner. I am, of course, I do love a pull-through. There's nothing better in the world than a pull-through. It makes me so happy. But what is your stance on this, Chris? I don't know if we're going to be able to have a spirited debate. It will depend on how you feel about this.
Well, when I first started seeing this maybe 20 years ago, I was like, are they driving a getaway car? And do they need to get away really quickly?
That's almost always the case. Yeah, it's almost always a bank heist when you see somebody do that. Yeah.
That was my thought. And then I started examining it as I do these things and thinking, well, is it faster in the aggregate of total time you're getting into a parking spot and getting out? Is it faster to back in and then get out? And my answer was, in my own logic, no, it's not, because you're backing into a confined space. It takes longer to get in there. And from my when I wasn't retired and I'm waiting for somebody to back into a space in a garage, it takes a lot longer, and you're sitting there waiting behind them for them to get
in. But, Chris,
Chris,
you have hit upon what I regard as the really fundamental truth of this, which is, ordinarily it's a matter of choice. You know, if you want to take a lot of time backing in and then you kind of pull forward a little bit because it's not perfect and, you know, check your mirrors and then kind of go back up again and stuff like that. If you want to do that, you know, that's your personal choice. It is. There's no way it's faster. There just isn't any way that is faster if you add up the aggregate time of backing in and then pulling out later. But the problem is the rest of us. Festivus is for the rest of us. So the rest of us are sitting there. Often you are blocking the lane while you're doing this. So the rest of us are forced to live with your, anal retentive need to do this odd bit of parking.
Exactamundo.
Okay, so we're on the same page here.
I will say there is an exception.
Yeah.
And that is if you're parking at an event, like a sporting event or a festival or something like that. In that case, it is really obnoxious and just, it does take longer if you're backing out and everybody else is worming their way to the exit.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But
so you can back out in one fell swoop. I mean, it's not like the backer inners where they got to do it two or three times. You know, I still feel we're on pretty good moral high ground here, Chris. But thanks so much for your call.
It could be a show, though.
Only on our show could that be a show, but it could be a show. He's absolutely right about this. All right, let's try to do one or two more calls here. We haven't taken any calls from women. So I'm going to start with Danielle, and then we're going to do Betty, and then we'll take a break here. So Danielle in Southington has a theory. I can't wait to hear your theory.
Well, this was quite heteronormative of you to assume that I am female. I'd like to start there,
okay,
if I may.
Oh, well, that's true. You could be a male, Danielle. Yes. Is that you could be a they? Okay.
I could.
Yeah.
Allow me to orient myself to you. My name is Danielle. I am queer, disabled, and neurodivergent, and a wonderful Connecticut resident. And I'd like to talk to you about spoon theory.
All right. I'm ready.
Okay. So if you're not familiar with spoon theory is the idea that in a day, anyone has a different amount of, like, energy. So if I go into my drawer to grab a spoon to eat a bowl of cereal, I may not have any less. So it's kind of this idea that I use to orient myself to others and the amount of energy I have in a day because I'm disabled. I might not have the spoon to shower in a morning, for instance, because of my disability.
So,
and I wanted to ask a little bit about your opinion, because I'm also an educator, about the difference between autonomy and independence, right? And why there, to me at least, seems to be this pressure towards independence versus autonomy in our society.
Tell me how you see that distinction being made, independence versus autonomy.
So if I were to go to the grocery store, for instance, I may need help from somebody. And that would be a way for me to maintain my spoons, for instance. I'm not using spoons to go to the grocery store and lift heavy things. But I'm not doing it independently because I've asked someone to assist me at the grocery store, right?
Yeah.
So I may be able to also gain community connection with another person by going to the grocery store with them, but there seems to be this pressure towards independence, right?
Yeah. I mean, I still don't see how it's distinct from autonomy, but I do get the point that you're making, which is, I mean, if however we're going to say that, okay, so independence... Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in other words, asking somebody to help you is, I would agree, however we're going to define our terms there, that's a good thing. You know, you're giving them an opportunity to do something good. You're maybe establishing a connection with them. You know, I do believe in the power of those small connections that we do have, those little interactions. I mean, if they're done pleasurably and politely and allow us to enjoy one another. I'll give you a quick example, and then I want to hear more about you.
Okay.
But I occasionally go to Costco, and I was in the Costco parking lot, which is in and of itself a very exciting place, recently. And a woman, I was walking towards the store, and a woman was walking out, and she had unloaded her cart, and she turned to me. She said, "Would you like this cart?" And then I said, "Is it seaworthy?" And she said, "It is seaworthy, and it doesn't." And then she used some kind of strange expression. I think she said something like, "It doesn't skip." And I knew what she meant, with that kind of single malfunctioning wheel of the cart that makes the cart, you know, not roll correctly. Whatever term she used, it wasn't the term that I would typically use. But I just thought, you know, here we had a very pleasant exchange, you know, and she understood right away what I meant by seaworthy. And I think that's a little bit of what you're talking about, these kind of micro-social encounters that you have if you ask somebody to help, you know, lift something into your cart or something like that, that there's an actual value in those.
Yes, but that's in, like, a micro-transaction. But I think also if we look at, like, the structure of our society and, for instance, like insurance, right? So I'm somebody who has 2 master's degrees, I've been gainfully employed my entire life. So when we're looking at these programs that are here for individuals in our state, I'm not really eligible for many of them. And I do feel like, right, I'm someone who could benefit from additional support. And so how do I get someone to come to the grocery store with me to do those things if I don't have those people inherently in my life, right? Because I don't have access to that privilege. How do I get that before I lose what insurance, let's say, looks at as independence, me being able to do things independently? I can't get help in my home to do that until I have something that really affects my level of independence to a point where I can't do things anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm kind of like, I don't know, in a nutshell getting at.
I think I see it now. That like the loss of independence, the opposite of independence is dependence. You don't want to be dependent, or at least that's a very different state than what we're talking about with autonomy. Autonomy means that you're capable of making decisions to direct the course of your life. I think I get it now. And it's a really interesting distinction, one I would be interested in thinking more about. Might even be a show that we do at some point.
Yeah, and within education, just so you know, there is a large push when we're looking at goals for students to have them be towards students doing things independently. So we're thinking about neurodivergent students. They may not feel comfortable yet. They may not have the skills yet. I myself identify as neurodivergent. And I think a lot of times, like, there are things in my life that have been really scary. And if somebody said, like, I could just do this with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have just a huge push towards everything must be by yourself.
Yeah. Well, we need to get over that, maybe. All right. Listen, Daniel, you have been a joy to talk to. I'm also very excited to report that the software has miraculously restored itself, so I can see all the calls that are coming in. And that allows me to say that I'm going to take a quick break here. But Dawn and John and Peter and Betty and Bill, you are all very much in my thoughts.
So
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Sum it up, my heart in a word, once and for all, spit it out and talk, see how we stumble and fall, it's a rock, a stone, it's a cloud needing a sun, it's a tree, you know, one we're swapping, then I can run, sum it up, agree, speak your mind, I'm in a mood, take it slow, we're in for better, maybe for good, it's a leap or go, it's a years passing me by, it's a road to show, it's a blessing that we can die.
Okay, so Mary Beth Eckhart's song is called Sum It Up, and I can't say much more about it because we got into this very complicated thing today about that song that eventually involved the expertise of the mayor of our jazz show, Gene Seymour, getting involved, and I can't really say it's by three different people. I don't know. I can't say much about it, but I really like it. It got into my head today, and I couldn't get it out. All right, here's what we're going to do. We've got a lot of calls here. We're going to deal, I think, expeditiously with the with the backing into parking spaces topic, and then we're going to deal with a couple of NPR-ish topics, including changes in hosts and just the general, you know, NPR controversies of today. So that is my plan. So we'll talk to Don and John about backing into parking spaces, and then we'll talk to Peter and Betty about NPR, and then we'll talk to Bill about something completely different. All right, the best laid plans, we know what happens with those, but let's give it a try. Hi, Don, you are on the air.
Hi, Collins. Nice to talk with you again. I wanted to add to, I am a backer in. If I can't find a pull-through space, I back in, and I do that because these days, it's very likely that a child is going to run behind my vehicle, and I'm going to back over it.
Hmm. That's a good reason.
Whereas if I'm facing outward, I'm going to see that child and I'm not going to run it over.
I think I haven't given a lot of thought to that. And that may speak ill of me, actually. But I mean, that's a very good moral, ethical reason. Although, of course, you might run over a child while you're backing into the space, too. What if they run behind you when you're backing in the space?
Less likely they would have to be weaving in and out of cars. But I am someone who uses all three mirrors.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm less likely, but that's certainly possible.
No, but I think you make a good case. I was just, you know, doing my lawyerly thing of poking holes in it. But
absolutely.
I think you make a very good case. Thanks for your call. It was a pleasure to talk to you. So we'll just continue with this for a brief second or two. Not that we're going to rush John through his thoughts, but we have John on the air, and then we're going to go to other topics. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I worked for the post office for 36 years, and we were mandated to back into parking spots. Well, first we were supposed to avoid backing up whenever we could, but when you approach a parking spot, you can see everything in the area, and you can know if it's clear, and then you use your mirrors to back up. Whereas if you pull in head first, when you're backing out, you know, first off, you're looking over your shoulder, or, you know, you're relying on your mirror that there's no blind spots. And it's not just children. It's, you know, it's oncoming cars or whatever. And especially, not in a postal vehicle, but if I'm in a car and I pull head first into a parking space and two giant SUVs park on either side of me, I can't see anything when I start to back up. So it really is a matter of safety.
You are back into
a parking spot.
You and Don are on the verge of converting me. I mean, I almost am ready to, you know, leave my old faith and join yours. I'm going to have to consider this. But never mind. I could talk more about this, but I think it's probably important that we move on to something else while we still have some tiny hint of credibility here. So let's talk to Betty from Roxbury. We'll also be talking to Peter from Wallingford about a related topic. But Betty, you have the floor.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. Sure. Okay, so I wanted to talk about the early Berlinger who resigned from NPR. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, I feel like he's sort of a disgruntled white guy talking about his disgruntlement. But then I've been a really faithful NPR listener for a long time, and I do find myself, I used to listen all day with no problem, and now there's so many shows that I just feel like have a perspective that either doesn't relate to me or is sort of boring, that I end up turning it off during the day, turning on The Bulwark or something else, that I feel like a bad liberal saying it, but I almost feel like he has a small point, and I just was getting your take on it. Maybe I'm just old.
Well, we are both old, and one thing I was talking about this with my class at Yale, they're all undergraduates, and you know, as we got into it, I said, you know, I'm a 69-year-old white man. I'm fundamentally an unreliable witness about this stuff. There's going to be a future 10 years from now that I will have probably no significant part of, other than ideally as a still living observer. And things will change, and things do change. And so with that as an pre-existing caveat, let me just say this. This did come up a couple of weeks ago when we did Ask or Tell Me Anything. What I'll say about Uri Berliner, I think some of the stuff in his piece is wrong. This, just to set the stage for people, this was a former business desk editor at NPR. He wrote a kind of a manifesto almost in the Free Press, which is a kind of, I don't know, semi-conservative, Barry Weiss-founded organization that's kind of very much specializes, I think in particular, of cultural critiques that seem to reject wokeness or any kind of prevailing progressive point of view. And he said that, yes, that NPR is too liberal, it's too woke. He gave three examples at the beginning, all of which I think are wrong. It was Hunter Biden's laptop, the Mueller report, and the COVID leak origins, or the COVID lab leak theory and the origins of COVID. I think he got almost everything wrong in those examples. He then mentioned the fact that at the NPR mothership, there were, he checked voter registrations, at least with the DC-based employees there, and there were 86 Democrats and zero Republicans in the newsroom. I have a little bit of a problem with that part, too, because there's a missing data point. I was emailing back and forth last week about this with Mike Pesca, former NPR reporter, who now hosts his own show, The Gist. And I said, you know, you have to know what the unaffiliated number is, because if there's zero Republicans, 86 Democrats, and 400 unaffiliated voters, then even the Democrats are kind of almost outliers at that point, you know. And if there's only, say, 100 unaffiliated voters, then Uri's, you know, number is a little bit more stark. And one of the arguments he makes that I think is worth talking about, I mean, like, I hope as an organization and as a brand, we do talk about it. He just says, you know, we've gone for diversity. We made it a North Star, particularly NPR itself, literally identified diversity or DEI stuff as a North Star. But he said we didn't do ideological diversity. So nobody really, you know, makes any effort to get, you know, and credit a responsible conservative point of view. I think that's the thing that we should probably talk about a little bit more. And I think there is some truth to it. And since he did it, I've actually made a little extra effort with some shows we've got coming up saying maybe we want to, you know, get somebody who really is a sensible conservative on about this, maybe make that special effort. And then I think the thing that you're talking about and is something that I hear from a lot of people, and I've been hearing it for years. People basically saying, people who are, you know, yeah, they're good liberals, they're, you know, long-lived, as our first caller would say, long-lived, you know, registered Democrats or just liberals or progressives or whatever. They're saying to me that they turn the radio off at a certain point because they feel they're being kind of lectured to about things that they already fundamentally believe in, but are just being told about it over and over again, or just such incredible efforts are being made to represent, you know, rather small groups of people over and over again, that they just feel less and less spoken to and more spoken at about issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's happened enough so that I think we have to acknowledge either the reality or the perception of reality that's contained therein. And I'm hoping that as an organization, as a brand, we're going to be able to talk about that without, you know, without bruising each other's feelings, without, you know, bursting up into flaming arguments. I think it's something we should at least explore and talk about, because we needed to become, I mean, I've been in public radio for 15 years. When I got here, it was really a white people thing. I mean, it really was a white people thing. And it's changed, and it's changed in good and necessary ways. But now I'm kind of hearing people say a little bit about, like, what you're saying. And I think that's worthy of some notice, too. I don't know.
Right.
Is that making any sense?
Yes, it's actually speaking to me. I feel guilty talking about it, but I don't know. It's sometimes I just have to turn the radio off for exactly the reasons you said. It just feels like I'm getting a lecture. That's a good description sometimes.
Yeah, we don't want to be...
I feel guilty saying it. No, I love NPR, but...
You're a nice person. You're not a bad person. No, I mean, if this was coming from, you know, the staff of the National Review or something, I would be less impressed. But the fact that it's coming from people like you, and you are far from the only person who said this to me, means to me that we need to at least take our temperature on that one and see if there's, you know, not some massive change, but some micro movement that we can do that corrects for that impression. So I thank you for this call, and I don't think you should beat yourself up. I think you should go out in the world and be a happy person, and either back into spaces or don't. I won't even judge you on that one. So we're going to talk to, I just did something that made it the wrong color. So what's that? Maybe what I'll do is, do I have Peter on the air? I have Peter on the air. Okay. So Peter, are you on the air? Are you with me? Oh, I just put him on hold. See, it's very complicated. You know what I'm going to do? Kat, I'm going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to Peter after the break. Trans Am in sunset gold, yeah, she's trans femme, a demigirl dream, she's my friend from a galaxy far away. I want you, I need you, my alien space queen, reach out for your love. All right, this is fun. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor, and our producer of this particular episode is Jonathan McPants. He's the one screening calls here. I'm the one ineptly operating the new phone system, but I think I'm doing. I think I might be doing better now. Peter from Wallingford, you have the floor.
Hi, Colin. This is Peter from Wallingford. I always like to hear your interesting topics. I'm waiting for the one about a power-hungry, flip-flopping, corrupt politician being reelected, but also about backing into traffic. Yeah, they back in next door to where they work, so they don't have to back into rush hour traffic. So that's always safer and quicker for them when they're anxious to leave work. Okay, yeah, about Sam Saunders, with It's Been a Minute, was the original lead person on It's Been a Minute, and of course, Chef Plum seemed to be the main person you had on Seasons, and now they're both, their shows seem to be mostly functioning with women in charge, or I don't know how you look at it. I mean, I'm always listening to NPR all day long, and I'm not a sports fanatic or a food programs person, but I do listen to those shows too. So just want to know if you had some comments about the change of hosts.
Yeah, actually, well, the good news is that Sam Sanders and Jeff Plum are now running a B&B together on Nantucket. And apparently it is doing very, very well. People love it. The food's great.
Yeah.
It's very comfortable. Yeah. So so Sam Sanders, and I'm just doing this from memory, and so, you know, pardon me if I get it wrong. But my recollection was that Sam was feeling a little bit stifled in public radio. I think there was a period of time where a whole series of fairly prominent radio personalities, I mean, I know this was true because we did an episode that included this, that people like Sam and Audie Cornish felt like the potential for growth here wasn't that great, or that they just weren't really in a good position to express themselves the way they wanted to. And so they went off and they did other things. And Sam I can't pull the name right out of my head right now, but Sam does have another podcast these days, and that's what he's doing. And with Jeff Plum, I'm not as sure. I don't know the background. The one thing that I will say, I couldn't be a bigger fan of Robin, the current host. She is wonderful. And, you know, Robin is somebody who came here as a producer. The minute she started hosting, I first of all thought, wow, she's just got a great voice, too. I mean, she's got an extraordinarily pleasant voice as a host, and she's very comfortable with that and does a great job. And so, I mean, no diss on Chef Plum, but I think we might have traded up a little bit. I'm thrilled to have Robin hosting that show. But there's no sinister plot behind any of this, if that's what you're worried about. All right, now we've got other things to deal with. Maybe I can deal with all this. I'm excited about several of these calls. Let's start with Bill, and then we've also got Mike and Tony. Anyway, we'll go with Bill for the beginning. Hi, Bill.
Colin, how are you?
Just fine.
Terrific. Hey, you were a print journalist, as I recall, when you got out of Yale, right?
Yes, I was.
My dad was an editor for about 40 years in a Connecticut paper, and he used to train cub reporters in fact-gathering and, you know, come down heavy on any opinionated reportage. He's been gone now about 40 years, but I can still see him if he was around today. And the question really is your opinion. Now, what's your take on it? Is the internet and or, you know, the broad media landscape we have going to improve in terms of factual reporting, or is the confirmation bias piece so enabled by all this mishmash of media that we have now that it's going to get worse? And what's your opinion on it?
I mean, I think it's a $1 billion question, and I don't want to sound like I'm ducking it, but let me just say this. This seminar that I teach at Yale, this is the fifth iteration this year of that seminar, and we just wrapped it up. And most semesters, we have a class motto. We come up with a motto. It kind of happens organically. And this time it was, is the news a specific thing, or is the news a collection of different accounts by different people about the same thing? And it's a massive epistemic question right now, I think, in America, and not one that can be wrapped up into a nice parcel. I think what has happened now is there is a kind of balkanization of truth, and people are... Yeah, you use the term confirmation bias. People are able to go to sources that will tell them, you know, will sort of enlarge their pre-existing understanding of the world. And priors are everything. And I think you see that with all major topics these days. I was just reading a great piece by Lydia Polgreen, is that her name, from the New York Times, about she went to the protests at Columbia. And she said, you know, how you see these things is very, very much conditioned by how you were feeling going in, what your priors were, because you'll just interpret the reality that you experience very, very differently. Now, that's not a radical idea, but it's a radical idea when we get to the whole idea of journalism, to your father's career, because journalism was at least predicated on the idea that there is such a thing as an actionable picture of reality, that there's something that we could agree upon that represents a factual account of what we've seen. And the opposite of that, of course, feels like this, you know, kind of relativistic agnosticism that makes, I think, all of us uncomfortable. I think we're living in that space right now, this kind of, you know, I'll use another word, buzzword, this kind of liminal space where we really can't decide whether there's a truth or whether people are just offering their own competing shadings of one set of facts. But I think what's gone now, and maybe this is what you're referring to, what's gone is the kind of journalism judge, the Cronkite kind of person who could say, oh, no, I've decided what this is, and I've decided Vietnam is a huge sucking hole that is going to pull us deeper and deeper into darkness, and we really need to start thinking about that in a different way. And very few people at that moment thought, well, that's just one opinion. It was like Walter Cronkite said it's probably true.
It was Uncle Walter.
Yeah, that's giving too much power probably to any one person, but it also assumes that there is a truth. And I think we're living in an era where people don't necessarily assume that there is a truth, or they're just very comfortable with the idea that the truth that they embrace, which they have reinforced by regular visits to Joe Rogan or wherever it is that they're going, that's what they're going to live with. That's their instruction manual for navigating life. And, yeah. I don't know. Your dad wouldn't like it, but I'm not sure what we can do about it.
And he was a Republican. Hey, I just want to ask you, Helium Brothers, does that band ring a bell?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, I know one of the guys. I just figured I had to ask that.
Right.
You can take care of the other callers.
I was always disappointed that they didn't sing in highly pitched cartoon voices. Okay, let's go to Mike in Woodbury and Tony in Noank, and probably we're going to start running around out of time somewhere around then. But hi, Mosey. Have I done anything with Mike? I did the wrong thing. Mike, are you there?
Hello? Yes, there I am.
Good.
Hi, Colin. How are you?
I'm just fine.
So this horrible news story that broke over the weekend about Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, killing her puppy, apparently because it was, misbehaved or she couldn't train it or whatever. Just imagine in the pre-Trump era, any politician, especially one, by the way, who wants to be vice president because she's apparently high on his list, admitting to killing a puppy. I mean, it would be inconceivable. I mean, the only reason that I guess that she did it is she thinks it's going to help her with the MAGA base and maybe with Trump. I mean, it's just the mind boggles.
Yeah. So let me just sort of say this. This is just one of these weird things. But that story broke sort of Friday, Saturday, as I recall.
Right.
Probably a little bit more Saturday than Friday. So on Thursday, we have two meetings a week of our producers. At the Thursday meeting, one of our producers... So bear in mind, it's Thursday. None of this has happened. One of our producers, McCusker the Whiz Kid, she reluctantly pitched an idea. I think it was based on a piece she'd read in The Atlantic about how we sort of almost fetishize certain species and we have, feelings about those species. But very specifically, she wanted to home in on the whole idea of dogs because, you could have... a movie like The Departed or something where, 58 people get killed over the course of 2.5 hours. And people just sit there and go, yep, somebody else get killed. There goes Martin Sheen. They're throwing him off a building. Spoiler. But, but you kill a dog and it's just, the only time you can do it is in John Wick where it's a precipitating event for four movies of mayhem visited on other human beings because somebody killed John Wick's dog, in the first few frames of the first movie. And it is, that's true. And I'm that way too. I can't stand to see animals get harmed in either fictional or real life situations. And I probably have, prioritize them over people. Certainly watching movies and television. I don't want to see a movie where a dog gets hurt.
But what it says about the current state of affairs, where, like as I said before, Trump, no politician would have said anything, would have admitted to that. I mean, it's just insane.
Well, I think,
things slipped so dramatically.
I think that things have slipped. And I think what you're talking about, it's not so much that Trump, although Trump doesn't have pets and has never had pets and all that kind of stuff, but I think it's more... There's just a permission structure for weirdos, I mean, there's Marjorie Taylor Greene with her Jewish space lasers and, there's Matt Gaetz. We could just go on and on. There are people, Lauren Boebert, there are people in politics now who would not be able to get elected given their backstories and their current behaviors. And those things are no longer problems. And then it goes to the top. There's a guy in court right now who feels as though, and his followers feel as though, it's a rather flimsy thing to go on trial about, having paid hush money to a porn star about an affair you had with her, while your wife was pregnant. And I mean, that's sort of nothing. And yes, we have lowered our standards. There's no doubt about that. All right, Tony, you're going to be the last call of the day.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Hey, so I watched the nose. Your discussion on that on Civil War, and I get where you guys were coming from with the journalism thing, but I kept thinking, there's a lot of all over the world, there's a lot of places where people are living like this now, and it's increasing and it's getting worse, and I'm looking at like these camps in the U.S. and stuff, and I'm thinking Americans won't live in camps and act like everything's, sort of okay and be hopeful. I mean, we export war. We're not ready for anything like that. We're not ready. We don't know what it's like to be, other than our we all live in this bubble for the most part. And I think, And I don't know if he was trying to make that point in a way, like, okay, you know, this is just a fantasy. You know, we can't, if America goes down like that, I see, you know, nuclear weapons. I don't see it becoming like just a country full of people with no power and no cars sitting around and waiting for something till the forces. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just overthinking it.
I don't know that you're overthinking it. I will say this. I think Alex Garland's movie, Civil War, some of it's about photojournalism, but it's also about what would it be like if there were a war going on. And one of the aspects of that in the reality of the movie is there are some people who are not experiencing it at all. If you live in Missouri or Colorado, it's just not happening. But I think the other part of that is that destabilization can happen very fast. And, you know, it starts with just sort of you get used to a certain level. Gets back to the previous caller, and you get used to a certain level of instability, and then you're not you can't see the big change coming. I think it is something we should probably worry about more than we do. All right, we have to go. Thanks very much to everybody who listened. We'll do more shows as the week goes along.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.